The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Senate Judiciary's Subcommittee on Human Rights and the Law held a hearing recently to shine a light on the pervasive abuse of pregnant women in prisons around the country. Here's Subcommittee Chair John Ossoff.
Welcome all, in particular to our witnesses. And before we begin, I want to take a moment to acknowledge your bravery and your courage in testifying today. We appreciate what it takes for you to be here, addressing a very difficult and personal subject in a public forum like this. And I do want to advise those in attendance and those tuned in across the nation that this is difficult subject matter, and viewer and listener discretion is advised for that reason. In February of this year, as chair of the Human Rights Subcommittee, I launched an investigation into state prison and jail conditions for pregnant and postpartum women. The subcommittee conducted site visits and interviewed more than 100 formerly and currently incarcerated women, civil rights and criminal defense attorneys, medical providers, advocates, doulas, and academics. Our staff also reviewed federal lawsuits and relevant public reports from the last 6 years, finding what I believe to be significant and pervasive abuse and mistreatment of pregnant and postpartum women behind bars. The subcommittee has identified more than 200 reported human rights abuses against pregnant and postpartum women at state prisons and jails nationwide. We've heard from mothers forced to give birth in prison showers, hallways, or on dirty cell floors. Mothers who gave birth into toilets after being told they were not in labor and that they should, quote, lie down and go back to their cells. Mothers who gave birth in their underwear after prison staff refused to help them and told them instead, quote, don't have that baby, and quote, you're not even pregnant. In all cases we reviewed, these women repeatedly requested and even begged for help. But help came too late, if at all, and in several cases, their babies did not survive. We heard from mothers whose infants were immediately taken away from them. The subcommittee received numerous reports that generally, infants born in a facility are taken from their mothers within 1 day of birth, and that their mothers often went months and sometimes even years without knowing what happened to their children. We heard from postpartum mothers who were placed in solitary confinement within days of giving birth without any medical care or mental health support. We heard from women who were shackled around their stomachs, wrists, and feet during pregnancy and birth, reportedly causing injuries and miscarriages. While 41 U.S. states reportedly have laws that prohibit or restrict such shackling, the subcommittee identified apparent violations in at least 16 of these states. The rights of women to humane prison conditions and adequate health care are recognized under the U.S. Constitution's Eighth Amendment, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the United Nations Convention Against Torture, the Nelson Mandela Rules, and the Bangkok Rules, among other international standards. The testimony and evidence we'll hear here today, however, presents a shocking and horrifying picture of pervasive abuse and mistreatment of pregnant women in American prisons and jails. The subcommittee will hear testimony from a woman who endured appalling conditions while pregnant and postpartum, including weeks of solitary confinement within days of giving birth. The subcommittee will also hear testimony from a mother of a woman who gave birth into a prison toilet after her pleas for medical attention were ignored by prison staff. Again, I want to thank you both sincerely for your courage in sharing what you and your families have experienced. We will also hear from an OBGYN physician who can speak to the inhumane conditions faced by pregnant, incarcerated women around the country and the tragic consequences for their health and safety. This is an active and ongoing inquiry by the subcommittee. We will continue to investigate human rights violations against pregnant and postpartum women in Georgia's prisons and jails and nationwide.
That was Senator John Ossoff, chair of the Senate Judiciary's Subcommittee on Human Rights and the Law, delivering a statement July 31st at the opening of a hearing examining the pervasive abuse of pregnant people in prisons and jails around the U.S. Witnesses delivered some powerful, deeply moving testimony at this hearing. Let's hear some. First, here's Jessica Umberger.
First, I would like to thank you all for allowing me this time to speak in this space. My name is Jessica Drew Umberger. I am a mother and proudly working at Policing Alternatives and Diversions Initiative, also known as PAD, in Atlanta, Georgia. In 2017 and 18, I was pregnant while serving a five-year sentence. I was held initially at Helms Facility, what they call the medical facility for the Georgia Department of Corrections. Those 9 months pregnant in prison and everything that followed was the worst experience of my entire life. At Helms, they treated us like animals. I was there for 9 months and I saw several babies born in the hallway when I was there. I remember women screaming for help and praying out loud for medical attention. All of us were scared, stressed, and vulnerable. I remember a woman in the room very next to mine screamed, "Help, I'm having my baby." The nurse on duty shouted down the hallway, "Shut up, you will see a doctor in the morning." The woman ended up giving birth on the bathroom floor. Sometimes people got lucky and the doctor would get there just in time to catch the baby. I remember praying, "God, please, don't let that be me." The officers played mean tricks by announcing at 4 a.m., "Wake up, you've got breakfast from Waffle House." We would rush down the same hallway, only to find there wasn't any Waffle House. They'd laugh at our confusion and disappointment. They also didn't properly feed us at all. Our food consisted of watered-down greens and soy patties, which left us all very hungry. This food tasted awful, and the cheese bread, which was the extra food we got because we were pregnant, was so bad, I still can't get the taste out of my mouth. I was most scared the morning I was to give birth. I was told by prison staff that because I had a C-section 18 years prior, it was Georgia Department of Corrections policy that I had to have another one. Even though I told them I wanted to have a vaginal birth, they told me it was not allowed. It is my strong belief that the prison staff wanted me to have a C-section to fit my birth into their hospital transport schedule. God had other plans. I ended up with preeclampsia and had to be rushed to a hospital. This is where my trauma turned for the worse. I was dropped off with officers I did not know at a hospital and was in a surgery room surrounded by strangers, doctors who never examined me and nurses I'd never met. When I explained to the doctor that I was told I had to have a C-section, but that I wanted a natural birth, the doctor said it sounded like coercion to him. My beautiful Jordan was born August 15th, 2018. I had only 2 short hours to hold and look at my baby. This would be the last time I would see her for a few years, 3 years, about 3 years. We were separated. She was taken to the neonatal unit, and I was taken to a dark basement where they kept the incarcerated people. In the basement, I was transferred from the rolling bed to a stationary bed. I had to be helped by a couple of nurses as I could not feel my legs. I remember the nurse asking the male sergeant to step out so she could clean me up. And he replied, "I can't do that, ma'am." She looked me in the eyes and quietly said, "I'm sorry." I proceeded to clean my private areas while the male sergeant watched. The next few days, I remember random men looking every hour into that small window of the locked door. I remember seeing feet of people walking by my caged window and thinking, if people only knew what was happening down here, what would they say, or would they even care? I was transported to Leerindale State Prison 3 days after giving birth. I asked if I could see my baby and tell her goodbye, but the transporting officer told me it would be in my best interest not to say goodbye. They wouldn't even provide an update on how she was doing. Once I arrived at Leerindale, I was placed in the infirmary in a room with a woman who had MRSA. This made me very uneasy as I had a large open wound in my abdomen. I asked for cleaning products and was given a large open, asked for cleaning products, and when I was given a thumbnail size amount of bleach in a pill cup. I was not given my property and therefore could not shower properly. I had been wearing the same underwear from the day I had gave birth, and I didn't have a change. When I would ask for pads, I was given one, maybe two if I was lucky. I must have complained too much about the room being unsanitary because I was told to grab my bedding, and I was taken to lockdown, where I was left for 3 weeks. I was put in solitary when my baby was only 5 days old. In solitary confinement, I had no medical support. The staples in my stomach from my C-section had not dissolved, and there was no air conditioner. Hot, laying there in August, trying to heal, my C-section wound became infected. I didn't know how I was going to make it. To tell the truth, I didn't think I would make it out of there alive. No one ever checked on my mental health postpartum. I was never screened for postpartum depression. And my six-week checkup consisted of a doctor asking, "How are you?" And I said, "Fine." He said, "Okay, good." When I was finally sent back to the general population, I spent a couple of weeks in a cell where I had to sleep on the floor because I physically could not climb on that top bunk. I came home in April of 2022, and it was clear that my kids had been serving time too. They'd had 5 homes during their 3 years in foster care, and they were traumatized. I was desperate to stitch my family back together, but finding housing, something that was necessary if I was going to get my kids out of foster care, was difficult with the criminal record. I must have applied for over 30 apartments, and I was repeatedly denied before I finally purchased a home. I had a mission to get a home and get my children back. I achieved my mission. Today we live together and we are all healing. But it's so clear that my kids were punished along with me. They never had been roller skating, never learned how to ride a bike or swim. They'd tell me they'd sit in a room all day in foster care. No opportunities, no activities. Nobody took them to the movies. I served my time, but my children and I will never fully be finished with my sentence. I am hopeful that my testimony will make a difference and that we might work together on alternatives that heal instead of harm families.
That was Jessica Umbarger testifying at a hearing of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Human Rights and the Law on January 31st about the pervasive abuse of pregnant people in prisons and jails around the U.S. Now here's Corrine LaBoy.
My name is Corrine LaBoy. I reside in New Braine, Connecticut. My daughter has been incarcerated at York Correctional Institute in Connecticut since August 2017. My daughter was around 6 weeks pregnant when she entered York Correctional. I stand before you today as a mother, as a grandmother, to tell you about our family's experience. From the moment my daughter entered York Correctional, our pregnancy added a layer of fear and uncertainty to our lives. Communication with her was very restricted, and I was denied contact for several weeks. When I finally heard her voice, she expressed a lot of distress and fear of being alone. She told me about times where she was denied adequate nutrition and medical attention. She was even threatened with solitary confinement for requesting to be sent to the infirmary. The prison staff forced her to choose between phone calls and recreation time, a cruel decision for any expecting mother. As my daughter's pregnancy progressed, I attend every court hearing, hoping to see her and assure myself of her well-being. Every time I saw her in court, she looked so sick, sweating a lot, hunched over. It was heartbreaking to witness her in heavy metal shackles around her belly, ankles, a practice that continued throughout her pregnancy. The darkest moments began in early February of 2018, when for two agonizing weeks, I received no word from my daughter. The days that followed were chaotic and deeply distressing. The Connecticut Department of Children and Families called me and informed me that she had given birth. DCF asked me to meet at my home to fill out paperwork so that I could go meet my granddaughter. Shortly after filing the papers, I learned that my granddaughter was in the NICU for being born premature and underweight, malnourished. When I went to the hospital, DCF met me there so that I could meet my granddaughter. During the custody process, I learned that my daughter had been medically neglected and that my granddaughter was born in the prison, not in the hospital like I thought. I was confused, I was scared. I knew my daughter was nearby because a nurse told me that she had put a big red ball in my granddaughter's hair. I felt relieved to know that my daughter saw my granddaughter. But nobody would tell me anything about my daughter or granddaughter. I could not see or talk to my daughter. I later learned that she was shackled to the hospital bed 4 days post-delivery, a practice that is not only inhumane, but also illegal in the state of Connecticut. In March 2019, I learned for the first time the full extent of how my granddaughter was born when my daughter initiated a lawsuit against the prison. The lawsuit settled a year later, revealed the horrifying truth. My granddaughter was not born in a hospital, as I had believed, but into a prison toilet after my daughter's desperate cries for help went unanswered. On February 9th, my daughter started experiencing labor symptoms, abdominal pain, and discharge. Medical and correctional staff dismissed her pleas, providing only a heating pad and instructing her to lie down for 4 more agonizing days. She told me she felt like a caged animal. Throughout her pregnancy at York, which pains me into this day. Through the lawsuit, I also learned that on February 13, my daughter began bleeding while using the toilet. She called for help, but nobody responded. Security camera footage shows my daughter placing a t-shirt between her legs, grasping the prison walls for support as she tried to walk to breakfast. When she came back, she sat on the toilet. The t-shirt was completely bloody. She began to scream for help when she realized her baby was coming. Nobody came. My granddaughter was born into the toilet bowl. She was unresponsive and not breathing once she was outside of my daughter's body. If not for my daughter's quick thinking and her cellmate's help to pat my granddaughter's back and get the water out of her, she would not be alive today. When prison staff finally arrived, their response was so cruel and insensitive. They joked that my granddaughter had took her first swim and proceeded to cut her umbilical cord inside a dirty prison cell, disregarding her dignity and well-being of both my daughter and my granddaughter. My daughter should have received proper medical care and support through her pregnancy, and my granddaughter should have been born in a safe and sanitary environment, not in a prison cell. This experience has left us scared and deeply distrustful of a system that failed to protect my daughter's basic human rights. No family should endure what mine has suffered. Prisons must do better to ensure families are informed throughout a woman's pregnancy and to prioritize the health and well-being of mother and child. My daughter was deprived of the medical care she desperately needed. No human being should endure such cruelty and neglect. No mother or grandmother should feel as helpless as I have felt. I urge this subcommittee to let my family's ordeal serve as a spark for a change and compassion in our criminal justice system. I want to thank you all for allowing me to share my daughter's and my granddaughter's story today. Thank you so much.
That was Corrine LeBoy testifying at a hearing January 31st about the pervasive abuse of pregnant people in prisons and jails around the U.S. Finally, here's Carolyn Suffren, MD, PhD, and Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine.
My name is Carolyn Suffren. I'm a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist and a PhD researcher at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. I'm also a fellow with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and I've spent the last 17 years working to understand and improve care and conditions for pregnant and postpartum incarcerated women. I've done so by providing clinical care inside a jail, conducting extensive research, publishing over 80 peer-reviewed articles, and writing national guidelines on best practices for care for this population. And the views I'm expressing today are my own, do not necessarily reflect those of Johns Hopkins University or Johns Hopkins Medicine. So I got into this work when I was called to a delivery when I was a first-year OBGYN resident doctor in training in Pennsylvania. Everything about the room was as usual. There were IV poles, fetal heart rate monitors, and a mother about to push a baby into the world. But one thing was different. The mom-to-be was shackled to the bed. Nothing in my training had prepared me for this moment. And since that night, 20 years ago, I've conducted dozens of research studies that have revealed systematic deficiencies in care for incarcerated pregnant and postpartum women. As I began to provide OBGYN care in a county jail, I tried to find out how many pregnant women are incarcerated and how many give birth while they're in custody. What I found was shocking. There were no such statistics. This was in 2015, less than 10 years ago. So my team at Johns Hopkins conducted the Pregnancy in Prison Statistics, or PIPS, study. From 2016 to 2017, 22 state prison systems, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and the five largest jails reported monthly pregnancy outcomes data to our study. And we found that in just that 1 year, there were 3,018 admissions of pregnant patients to these facilities, and over 1,000 of these pregnancies ended in custody, with 897 births. Now, when we extrapolate these data nationally, we estimated that there are nearly 58,000 admissions of pregnant women to U.S. jails and prisons each year. And yet PIPS was a one-time study. It could not include all 50 states or all 3,000-plus jails. And so there remains today no full national count of pregnancy and births in prisons and jails. So if we don't know how many pregnant women are behind bars, then people think they don't exist. And if people think they don't exist, then it makes it easy for prisons and jails to neglect their health care needs, as you've heard so tragically today. And indeed, this is what my and others' research has shown, and what you've already heard from Ms. LeBoy and Ms. Umberger. There are no mandatory standards for pregnancy care that prisons and jails must follow. And so research has shown that access to such care is variable, often substandard, or even absent. For instance, in a survey my team conducted of all U.S. jails, only 31% did routine pregnancy testing within 2 weeks of arrival. So if jails don't test for pregnancy, then they can proceed as though there are no pregnant women in custody. This means that many pregnant patients will have time-sensitive medical needs that go unaddressed. My research has also documented alarming deficiencies in life-saving care for the estimated 8,000 incarcerated pregnant women with opioid use disorder. Although the long-established standard of care in pregnancy is treatment with methadone or buprenorphine, in our national survey of jails, only 32% of them provided pregnant women with access to these medications. And even at facilities that did provide treatment in pregnancy, 3/4 of them forced patients to go off medications after the baby was born. This puts mothers and babies at risk for severe harm, including deadly overdose. And we know that opioid overdose is a leading cause of maternal mortality in the United States. Now, when it comes to the issue of shackling pregnant women, it's well established that this increases the risks of medical harms during labor and throughout pregnancy. As we have heard, 41 states and the District of Columbia now have laws prohibiting the practice. However, they are not always followed. In the PIP study, 4 departments of corrections had policies or practices that violated state law and allowed shackling.
That was Carolyn Suffren, MD, PhD, and Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, testifying at a hearing of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Human Rights and the Law on January 31st about the pervasive abuse of pregnant women in prisons and jails around the U.S. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is
for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.